another edition of the Terry Collins Show. I'm John Arezzi. Joining me, as always, he's the namesake for the show, the former skipper of the New York Mets, an analyst for SNY's Baseball Night in New York, direct from Port St. Lucie, Florida, Terry Collins. Terry, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, John. I'm doing great. Excited for another great show. And, you know, it's been a lot of fun, and hopefully the fans are enjoying it as much as I am.
Oh, these fans are enjoying it. We know every single day because we see these numbers just like skyrocketing. And I got to tell you, each week I discover more about how beloved you are because of the fan base that's been watching this on YouTube, the clips we've had on Instagram, and it's really great. The fans are loving it because they love the conversation. They love being able to see you every week and get your opinion. So we're going to dive into it. Of course, we got a special one today. We will be talking with the former Met and the 2012 Cy Young Award winner in the National League, the knuckleball artist, none other than R.A. Dickey.
Yeah, it's going to be great. You know, he's such a special guy, and what a year. I mean, John, I got to tell you, I used to talk to Josh Tolley, who caught R.A. the whole season, and there were nights this poor guy was exhausted when the game was over because it was such a challenge just to catch it. I mean, and there were balls that would bounce off his mask and, you know, he'd go to catch it and it would move at the last second, hit him in the chest. And I mean, the poor kid just beat himself up and yet did an absolutely great job calling games for R.A. Dickey. And it's great to have R.A. on today.
Yeah. And then Josh had to follow him up to Toronto.
Yes, he did. You better take somebody that could catch that thing. I'll tell you, because it's not easy.
Yes. So we can't wait for that. That's coming up shortly. But before we bring on R.A., let's go to the Mets and what's been going on with our Mets. They've now won five straight series. They're over 500. They're playing great baseball, even with a few key injuries that happened on the road trip. Talk to us about what you're liking about the Mets right now.
Well, you know, it's quite obvious. They got off to a slow start, came out of spring training, got off to a tough start, but we know it's a long, long year. There's many stories of teams that get off to slow starts and yet still have great seasons. Well, they started playing. They've gotten very good pitching. Their starting pitching has really stepped up, even though they've lost Senga. Their bullpen, the middle part of their bullpen, which they were very concerned at coming out of spring training, they've stepped up and done a great job to bridge that gap to get to Diaz. You know, the bats, we've always known that their lineup is going to be pretty good. And, you know, a couple guys got off to slow starts. Lindor's gotten off to a slow start. Actually, Brandon Nimmo's gotten off to a slow start. But they've seemed to, you know, big guys. Some guys have picked him up from, you know, different guys, from Taylor to Stewart. You know, they've gotten big hits. And that's what you've got to do when you're in a marathon like the 162-game season. You can't ride three guys. You're going to need a lot of other guys to contribute, and they're starting to get that out of some guys. Plus, their defense, you know, has really, really helped them. They've made great plays. Having Marte back healthy in right field, he's made some good plays. Brett Beatty at third base is, you know, his confidence is off the charts right now, and he's really, really improved defensively. So, yeah, they're in a good spot. And as we know, you keep winning series as you go through the season, you win every – just, you know, you're going to look up at the end, and you're going to be very happy to see where you are.
Oh, yeah, when you can win series after series, that's what it takes. And for a manager, when a team gets on a roll, what do you do as the manager to keep this momentum going, not only on the field but in the clubhouse?
Well, you got to stay out of the way, most of all, because they know they're playing good. And you don't want to overmanage right now. You want to let – you know, everybody's feeling good about what they're doing. Everybody knows they've got a role. Keep them in those roles. You know, be it where you're platooning your right and left-hander at the DH position. You know, you're letting those guys play every day. Lindor, actually Alonso, and before Brett Beatty got hurt the other day, he's been in the lineup every day. And so those guys know, hey, when they come to the ballpark, they know they're in the game. They know they're, you know, what's going on. And if you're going to give somebody a day off, you need to prep them so that, you know, the guy who's replacing them is ready and those guys can kind of anticipate. Because you don't want to surprise him. When you're playing good, you don't want to have a player walk in and be surprised that he's not playing. So, you know, one of the big things is to continue what's worked. Don't try to overreact. And I think Carlos has really done an outstanding job of being the same guy on a daily basis.
the consistency certainly has been there. And as you said, all these guys come to the ballpark knowing that where their role is, what their piece is as part of this whole team. And it's been wonderful to see. It really has. I want to talk to you about Francisco Alvarez. Obviously, that was a big blow over the weekend. He's out with a torn ligament in his thumb, a big blow to the team. He'll be getting surgery, and it could be out. Estimates are 6 to 8 weeks. As a manager who's dealt with players going down who are really key parts of a team during a season, talk to us about losing that key component of your starting lineup.
Well, everybody knows it's big. Everybody knows it hurts the club. But as a manager, you can't act like it does. You got to say, hey, it's next man up. Just to, that's what the game's about. Injuries, everybody's going to have them throughout the season, John. And you and I have talked about, hey, look, the one thing you can't do is look like the other team feels sorry for you. They do not. So you got to go bring up a piece. They brought up Tomas Nito, who's got, you know, 3-4 years with the Mets anyway. He knows the staff. He knows this, knows New York, knows what's expected. Pretty good catch and throw guy. You know, and we all know, I always thought, if he started worrying about hitting the ball right center field, he's a real good hitter. This guy won a batting title in the minor leagues, so he knows how to put the bat on the ball. It's going to give Nevias a chance to get in there a little bit more. We might see a little more consistency from the left side out of him now that he's going to play a little bit more. So, you know, again, they now realize, hey, look, everybody wants to help. Everybody wants to be a part of a winner. And now there's some situations when guys start going down, these guys that are coming up to replace them, there's expectations and they know it. And a lot of these guys rise to the occasion.
One guy that's rising to the occasion who came out of nowhere, let's just put it that way. He's been a journeyman. He hasn't even had a lot of innings in the major leagues over the course of his career. And that's a 31-year-old reliever by the name of Reed Garrett, who has a 0 ERA as we tape this show. Talk to us about a guy like that coming into this season, not a lot of high expectations on him. And now he's becoming, other than Diaz, the most important member of that relief team.
Well, there are great stories on every team, for sure. And, you know, I've said it for a long time, John. Every team, there has to be a surprise. The teams that win, something happens on those clubs that you don't expect. It might even be your best player. Like, let's just say Pete Alonso hitting 65 homers. You know, we all know he's going to hit 40, but he hits 65. That's a surprise. Reed Garrett's a surprise. But you know what? You got to pat guys like that on the back. He's got an opportunity, and he's running with it. And you got to just let him continue to run with it. You know, it may be short-lived. Nobody knows. But right now, he got great confidence in his stuff. And when that and confidence plays in the big leagues, it's the most important thing because they're all talented guys. When you trust your stuff and you think you can get out, you're going to get outs. And Reed's been a big piece of that bullpen. He's allowed Ottavino to have some time off. Last weekend he came in because they had to use Diaz early in the game. He came in and got the save. So I mean, again, those are the great stories that winning teams have at the end of the year that guys they don't expect come through for them.
Yeah, he came in and got his first save of his career during that game where Diaz came in and then Reed comes in. 1, 2, 3 strikeouts, and he gets the save. So it's been great to see. The other thing that's been great to see most recently is Francisco Lindor. His bat starting to come alive from the left side. He got his first home run in during the Dodgers series. But one thing that really stood out to me, and I wanted to ask you about, it was like before the last homestand, and he was struggling, Mets owner Steve Cohen sent out a tweet or on X that we should all stand behind Francisco Lindor and give him a standing O at the opening of the homestand. And the fans responded to that. Can you recall a time during your experience where something similar has happened, where you're getting behind a player that may be having a rough stretch and then he responds and feels really good about what the fan base is, how the fan base is reacting to him, even though he's in a slump?
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever seen an owner do it. I've been in situations where a guy's really having a tough time and all the guys in the clubhouse rally around him. You know, they're there. They're patting him on the back every day. They're, you know, they're helping him. They're in the batting cages, you know, trying to make sure his confidence stays up. I've seen that. But I thought the move by Steve was outstanding. You know, Steve's beloved by the Mets fans because of what he's tried to do here with, you know, funneling money in to try to give him a win, get him a winner and keep the excitement in Queens high. And so I think it was a great move, and the fans responded. And that just tells you about Mets fans. They are passionate about the team. And here, if they can help, if this standing up and giving this guy a standing ovation, if this is going to help the team, they're in for it. They're willing to do it. And they did it. And we're starting to see Francisco come out of his little slump at the beginning of the season. And we all know he's too good a player to keep that going. You know, we know he's going to start hitting. And certainly we got to get him going left-handed because you're going to see more right-handed pitching. It's just the percentages of the game. So we need to get that bat going from the left side. But I thought it was a great move. But you know what? The one thing about Francisco, he's been around long enough. He's been a veteran enough. Even though it does hurt you a little bit when you're at, you know, it kind of motivates you at the same time. And so I thought it was a great move, and I think you're going to see some real benefits of it.
Yeah, I think so as well, Terry. And another thing that happened, the Mets are changing their look, at least for Saturdays. This past weekend, they unveiled their new Nike City Connect jerseys. They're unlike any other uniform the Mets have ever had in their history. They have the NYC on the chest with a dark gray and asphalt color with a purple trim. They're kind of reminiscent of some of the New York Yankee uniforms of the early 1920s, the way they're designed in a way. What do you think of the new look for the Saturday games this season? And what was your favorite jersey when you managed the Mets?
Well, welcome to modern day baseball. I mean, that's, you know, I love the Mets uniforms. I'm not a big, you know, change the uniform up. Okay, it's one game. I get it. You know, everybody's doing it kind of, you know, it's great for marketing. There's going to be fans who are going to love it. So they're going to go out and pay $150 to have one of those jerseys on there. That's great. I think that's wonderful. The team, I'll tell you what, you could put me in those white uniforms every day for me at home. So, and I will tell you, I've had a lot of great uniforms. I thought our uniform in Houston, when I first got there, they were brand new. They called it midnight blue, and we had a gold star. They were beautiful uniforms. But I'll tell you, that pure white Mets uniform with the Mets across the front, that to me is the class. That's what Major League Baseball uniforms are supposed to look like. And I always loved them the days we wore the plain white ones. But you know what? If this is going to arouse people having to have something new, then more, good for everybody, good for the organization.
Yeah, I heard they're also on these Saturdays, they're going to even the whole layout of the stadium, the lighting, the concession stand lighting is all going to be the City Connect theme. So we'll see how it goes. We'll be anxious to head out to Citi Field on a Saturday to check it all out. Finally, Terry, what we're going to do each and every week, I mean, the Mets have this storied history, and we're going to talk about one thing that happened in their history. So this week in Mets history, April 20th, 1967, Tom Seaver secured his first career win. Seaver went 7 1/3 innings. He allowed just one run on five strikeouts, no walks, and he led the Amazings to a 6-1 victory over the Chicago Cubs in front of a gigantic crowd at Shea Stadium on a Thursday afternoon of 5,379 fans. Terry, question to you. Any personal memories of Tom Seaver that you'd like to share with us today?
When he was the best and the greatest, I was coming through the minor leagues in 67. I was a senior in high school. But, you know, when I finally got up to where I had a chance to see him, he had retired. But I will tell you this, that 5,300 people were at that game. 15 years later, there were 50,000 people that would say, oh, I was at that game, his first win. So, you know, that's how those stories grow. But obviously, he set the tone for what the future was like. And, you know, I wish I'd have been one of those 5,300 because there's nothing like seeing the greatest players in the world perform. And he obviously was one of those guys. So to be able to be around and see him. And again, you know, you talk to the guys that faced him, which I used to talk to a lot of guys. You know, I spent all those years with the Dodgers, and you talk, how'd you like to face Seaver? And you didn't find anybody that was very comfortable facing Tom Seaver. So, and that those were, you know, there was once, I remember talking to Koufax one time asking about Mickey Mantle. He said, I didn't have any trouble with Mickey Mantle, but I couldn't get Roberto Clemente out. You know, so those guys that, you know, there's going to be those guys that said, I haven't found anybody yet that said, oh, no, I really hit Saber good. You know, you don't, those guys don't exist. So obviously that was the start of a tremendous career for Tom.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Terry. And now it's time for Talking with TC. Today's Talking with TC guest pitched for Terry as a New York Met in 2011 and 2012. Over his career, which spanned from 2001 to 2017, he pitched for 6 major league clubs. His 2012 season will long be remembered by Mets fans. That year, he had one of the greatest seasons in franchise history, becoming the third Mets pitcher to win a Cy Young Award, joining Tom Seaver and Doc Gooden as the only other Mets recipients to get that honor. He was the first knuckleballer in Major League Baseball history to win the Cy Young. His trade to the Toronto Blue Jays after the season brought him north of the border, where he continued his winning ways. In 2015, he became the first pitcher in Major League Baseball history to make his postseason debut at the age of 40 years old. A 2012 All-Star and an NL strikeout leader, a 2013 Gold Glover, a New York Times best-selling author, and a man who's lived an incredible life. It's an honor to welcome R.A. Dickey to the Terry Collins Show.
Well, thanks for having me. You got to remember, too, I also am number one in the world in home runs given up in a single game, too. So you got to include that stuff, too, right? Wild pitches, too. No, I'm number one. I think there's 20,500 major league players to ever have played the game of baseball at the major league level. I'm number one at wild pitches and home runs given up in a single game. So you got to count those two.
Well, I will tell you, all right, it is a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm so excited to get to talk to you again. It's been a while since we've been able to converse. And obviously, you know, one of my favorite people I've ever been around. And, you know, we're going to have a lot of questions to ask. I think probably the fans, you know, the biggest question that everybody wants to know is, so how did the event of the knuckleball come about?
Well, you know, it's, you know, you're always the product of people who have loved on you well. And a couple of people who did that for me were Buck Showalter and Oral Hershiser. Those two guys saw something in me at a time in my career where I couldn't see it in myself. And they said, hey, we think you got a really good knuckleball and we want to give you the latitude to go down and try to develop that. They had seen Tim Wakefield come into Texas for a number of years and just, you know, shut him down. And they said, we want one of those guys. And so Oral was walking behind me one day when I was playing catch with my catch partner, and he saw me throw a knuckleball, and my catch partner put his glove up here. The ball went off his chest. And, you know, he kind of registered that, like, hey, this is something that he may be able to do down the road. And it was a year after that where they asked me to go down to AAA and start that journey. And that was in 2005, Terry, when that happened. They called me in the office after a poor outing as a conventional pitcher. And they said, hey, man, it's just not going to work out anymore at the big league level for you, throwing 87, 88 miles an hour in the AL West. It's just too tough. And we think you have a good knuckleball. We want to give you the opportunity to go down there. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I've only known one organization, maybe another organization would like me. And they said, well, that's really going to be your only option with us. And I said, I'll take it. So I went down to AAA in Oklahoma City and started that journey.
So, all right. So when you got out of college, I mean, you're number one pick. Is that correct? 18th pick in the country. So here you were, a conventional pitcher. You had to have great confidence in your stuff. So, you know, as you were coming after you first signed and we're in the minor leagues, was there any part of you that said, hey, my stuff's just not going to be good enough? Or was it, had you always tinkered with the knuckleball, or was it just something that, you know, one day you just threw one and it worked?
You know, my grandfather taught me the grip. I'll never forget. I was at the kitchen table. I was a young boy, you know, this is the power of influence that grandparents have over their grandkids. But he pulled out a scrapbook. I was probably 11 years old, 12 years old. He pulled out an old scrapbook and he opened the scrapbook, and in the scrapbook was an article about my grandfather. And it said, in a 7-inning game, he struck out 20 of 21 hitters and he threw knuckleballs primarily. And I was, that was my first exposure to a knuckleball. I never heard of it before then. And he's, and this was at a time when, you know, I was starting to stand out as like an amateur pitcher, like at 12, 13 years old. And he said, "Hey man, you might want to think about this one day." And he showed me the grip and I just kind of filed it away. I didn't even mess with it. And, you know, I'd play catch with it on the side every so often in high school and on the Olympic team. And, you know, in my minor league career, I would just goof off with it because I was a hard thrower. I was drafted as a conventional pitcher throwing 95 miles an hour. And so, you know, I thought that's who I'm going to be. That's it. And I just had fun with the knuckleball. And that year by year, every spring training, I seemed to come back. I'd lose about a mile an hour off my fastball. And I wasn't hurt, just general attrition. I'd thrown a million innings in college, Olympic team, you know, and it just over time, all that tissue got, you know, got soft. And I couldn't generate the arm speeds that I once could. By 2005, I was throwing 86, 87, 88 miles an hour in the AL West. And, you know, it was going to be too difficult. And so that was kind of my journey as a, you know, as a conventional guy that turned into a knuckleball pitcher. But I believed that I had what it took until somebody had to pull me inside and say, "Hey man, we love you enough to give you an opportunity here. You should probably take it." And so I did.
So, you know, you make your journey, you're pitching in the big leagues. Now, when you were in Minnesota, were you a knuckleballer then? Was it strictly knuckleballs? Because I saw you pitch one night in Tampa Bay and I remember some fastballs and curveballs in that.
When I started, like, and one of the things that Phil Niekro was so valuable, and Tim and Charlie Huff, those were like my three guys were Charlie Huff, Tim Wakefield, and Phil Niekro. And you know how tight that fraternity is, Terry. There's just not a lot of people who throw it and not a lot of people who can coach it. And so, you know, the first lesson Charlie Huff ever gave me was, "Hey man, you're going to have to be your own best coach." And so I've tried to be a sponge from then on. And, you know, as I started to gain confidence, I started to take that knuckleball from probably when you saw me pitch against Tampa, I was probably, you know, 50, 60, 70% knuckleballs on a great day. And as I got confidence with the pitch, I started to throw it 80 and 90%. And Phil Niekro was a big part of that. You know, he said, "Hey man," he said, part of being a knuckleball pitcher is that you can't have a foot in both buckets. The hitter has to believe that you're going to throw a knuckleball every pitch. That's one of the things that makes it a tough pitch to hit. And so that's what I did. I started committing to that, but it took Phil kind of challenging me with that. But you're correct. Early on in my knuckleball journey, you know, I was kind of a hybrid. I would throw a lot of knuckleballs about half the time, but then I would try to get back in the count with a sinker or a curveball. Or, you know, if my knuckleball wasn't great, I would abandon it completely. And I'd go. And the more I started to really have faith in that knuckleball, that's when my career really took off.
So, Ari, remember the first time that I got to meet you, I was the field coordinator for the Mets, and you had been sent back in spring training my first year with the Mets. And, you know, yeah, it's one of the great stories I've ever heard, because we had the facial hair policy in the minor leagues. You know, and I know you had the beard and you came down. And I said, "Hey, you got to get that beard shaved." And your answer was, "My kids won't even know me because I've had a beard." But so tell the people want to know, tell them the story about how you got rid of the beard.
You know, I had a beard pretty much from out of college all the way until you and I, to be honest. And I was, you know, at that time, Terry, I'm a 36-year-old man with three kids. You know, I'm thinking, well, you know, I wasn't even thinking that I was going to have to shave a beard for like minor league protocol. And I was the first, you know, in 2010, Terry, I was the first guy out of camp. So I was the first send out I'd come off a year with Minnesota that was okay, but it wasn't great, but I didn't have a great spring training. And, you know, they didn't really have a need for it at that moment. And so they sent me out and we started working. But I remember you came to me on the side. We were playing catch. I was in my uniform and you were so sweet because in your heart, I knew you didn't want to do it because, you know, I'm an older player. I was a veteran. Like, you know, I have kids. You said, "Hey man, I hate to tell you this, but, you know, we can't have an exception to the rule and we have a no facial hair policy." And I said, "Terry, that's going to be a tough one because I don't know if my kids will recognize me without my beard." And so what we did is that night, you know, of course I was going to respect the rule. I went home and we had like a ceremony and Ann had like prepared, you know, the Clippers, and everybody got to participate taking a stripe off my beard. So at the end of it, you know, I looked like I was 12 years old, but at least they knew it was their dad. You know, I didn't just show up unshaven and they're like, oh my God, who is that? They got to participate in it. So it actually, you actually helped me have a really nice family exercise. But it was hilarious.
Well, you know, I hope I didn't spoil it, but I did hate to say it, but you know, you came back, so they send you down, and I think you went AAA a month, maybe
a month.
Before you got recalled back to the big leagues. Yeah. And then, you know, and then the next year, I mean, it was craziness. You just kept pitching and pitching, but that season, that year that you won the Cy Young, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And you know what? I got to contribute a little bit. I got to send out a little thank you to Josh Toley for, you know, because you wore him out. You know, he did everything he could to catch you. You were so dynamic. That poor guy, he had a lot of sleepless nights knowing that he had to catch you the next day.
He was great.
So, hey, Ari, that year, he was the best. That year, what do you think the best game you pitched that year was? Can you come up with it? Because I have one in mind.
You know, I think it's, to be honest with you, I think it's a tie for me. I love the back-to-back one hitters, but the one in Tampa, I just, you know, like I go to sleep at night sometimes as a 49-year-old man and remember every pitch that I threw in that game as I fall asleep, because it's like my happy place, right? It's that game for me was when I felt like I could do whatever I wanted with that pitch whenever I wanted to do it. And it did carry over to the next outing against Baltimore, but that outing against Baltimore, it was a great outing, but the way I felt in that outing, it wasn't like Tampa. I had another outing. You might remember this. I was coming off, you know, there's all that hoopla and, you know, it was back-to-back one hitters. And then we faced New York on Sunday Night Baseball, and it was just pandemonium. You know, I was going against CC Sabathia, and, you know, I was getting pulled in every direction, and you were so awesome. You tried to protect me from all that. I remember you calling me in the office even and saying, hey, man, we got to find a way to, you know, get you so that you can stay in your routine and do your stuff. And I remember it being a hard week. And I gave up 5 runs in 5 innings that outing. The next outing, we went to L.A., and we were in Dodger Stadium, and that was one of my favorite outings of the year. So I think the L.A. and the Tampa for me were the outings that I really, really enjoyed the most probably that year.
Yeah, well, I will tell you, I told these guys before we started the podcast, I said, I've got to ask them about this outing in Tampa Bay, because I've never seen anything like it. You know, matter of fact, David, who makes all the plays, had a tough play on a chopper that the only hit they got was a little chopper down the third baseline. That was a tough play. But I remember Josh Toley coming back to the bench after, I don't know, fourth or fifth inning. He said, Terry, the hitters are talking to themselves in the batter's box. And you threw a knuckleball to a right-handed hitter who dove out of the batter's box, and the ball ended up being a strike. And he got up and he was laughing. I mean, the opposition was laughing. And Josh said, one of the guys said, how are we supposed to hit this? So, I mean, I have never seen a major league team dominated so much. And you know what? I think they actually enjoyed it. It became a contest. Hey, who can put this thing in play? And that, you know, it was amazing. And I have not forgotten. And there were so many other great outings that, you know, and to be able to have the wherewithal, the confidence and the daring to throw that pitch in deep counts, you know, 3-2 count, or 3-1 count, and yet, and throw it for a strike. I mean, you know, you had it going, and certainly, and I've also told the story that, you know, which I immensely appreciated, and you will never find anybody doing it today. I remember at the end of the year, I wanted you to win 20 games so bad. I called you and said, hey, would you be willing to go on 3 days rest? And you looked at me and you said, if you need it, yes. And it was, if we needed it. And I'm thinking, you know, you talk about a good teammate. It's not, and we weren't going to finish. We weren't going to the playoffs. And yet you were willing to sacrifice everything for the team. And I'm thinking, I got to get this guy out there because I know if he gets a couple more starts, he's going to win 20 games. And I will never forget, you just, yeah, if you need it, that's fine. And it had nothing to do with us. And I've always appreciated that about
you. Thanks for saying that. That's an encouragement. I tell you that I remember we were rolling that around for a few weeks there when we were trying to stay in the playoff hunt there at the end of the season before it got away from us. And, you know, it was a pitch. It's a pitch that allows you, of course, to be able to recover more quickly. And so, you know, even at age, I think I was 37 at that time, you know, it was still something that I felt like my body could handle. And, you know, and also, you know, I was kind of a holdover from, you know, my first year in the big leagues, Terry, was 2001. And so, like, those are the years when if you didn't throw seven innings, you were a failure. Like that, like, and if you didn't take the ball and throw 200 innings as a starter, like, you were a failure. Like, that is the mentality that was instilled in me by Ken Hill and Roger Pavlik and Bobby Witt and, like, all those old guys that came up with me. And then as I got older and older and started talking to Oral and, like, looking at his stats, and I mean, these guys threw on 3 days rest routinely like it was no big deal. And so, you know, that was a more of a mindset for me too, is, and I knew you appreciated that. And I remember you telling me that, but, you know, at the same time, like, I was at a place where I really enjoyed my craft, man. And the more I could get out there, the better. Like, I loved the feel of it in my hand. I think there were a couple of outings when we were kicking around, going down to the bullpen and maybe setting up, or, you know, just on my bullpen day, instead of taking my bullpen, we'd go down and maybe think about getting an inning or two out of the pen, because it might be a way to bridge to, you know, Bobby Parnell or, you know, whoever else the closer was. And, you know, we kicked a lot of fun ideas around that year. But, you know, it was a special year. I just want to say, I don't know if I've ever done this publicly, but I just want to tell you thank you for making me go back out for the eighth inning against Pittsburgh in the 20th win. You know, I was gassed a little bit, and you looked at me and you said, "Hey, man, these people, you know, they want to see you. And you look like you've got more left." And it just motivated me, like, yeah, I think I do. And one of the things that was great about our relationship is that we had great communication. I don't know if I've ever had as good a communication with a manager as I did with you. And you always listened to what I had to say. You would challenge me. And that was one of those times where I was appreciate you challenging me. So thank you.
Well, you bet. You know, all right, one of the things I've always respected about, there were certain things I used to look for in players. And, you know, that was, you know, taking your job and making it serious. I mean, you held runners on. You had a great move to first. You had great feet to hold runners on because you needed to, throwing a knuckleball. You needed to keep runners close. And you did that. You handled the bat. I mean, well, how big was that bat? Yeah. 38 inches? I mean, you had that giant inches. Bat. And yet, 37 inches. And I don't ever remember you not getting a bunt down when I asked you to sacrifice a bunt. You got every bunt down. I mean, you did the little things because you took pride, you know, those were priorities to you to make sure you were a quality pitcher. And I just thought it was one of the great things that, you know, that I love professional athletes who take their trade seriously. And you were one of those guys. And, you know, you did all the little things. And I just thought it was great. Hey, during that, during the season, did you have communication with some of those other? Because you probably didn't call Wakefield, did you? Because he's on the other team once in a while. But did you call any of those guys?
One of the beauties, Terry, about that small fraternity, I'll never forget. Like, Tim, I was going poorly in Seattle, and we were playing the Red Sox, and I was a member of the bullpen of the Seattle Mariners. And he came through town. He sent the clubby over to me, and he said, "Hey, I'm throwing a bullpen at 3:30. Why don't you come watch it?" I mean, this is a guy that's trying to beat him if I get in the game, yet he wanted to perpetuate the craft of the knuckleball. He knew how hard it was. He knew that I was in my infancy as a knuckleball pitcher, and just was so generous with his time. And Phil and Charlie Huff and Tim were always on my speed dial during the year. I bet I talked to Phil Niekro, you know, once a month at least during the Cy Young year. I talked to Tim a couple times because they all had something different that they gave me that was unique to them that I got to apply and add my own personality with the pitch. So if I would, for instance, if I was struggling with my mechanic, like from the waist down, I would always call Phil, because Phil was the one that helped me get my hips going to produce the high speeds of that knuckleball. And once I embraced throwing that knuckleball hard as crap, that's when I started to kind of have that trajectory, because there had been nobody else that threw it in the low 80s, you know, maybe Joe Nico, but right. Each of those guys really invested into me in a way that they gave me something unique that I was able to kind of practice and put into game situations that helped me. And so when one of those things were off, you know, if it was my grip, I'd call Charlie Huff. If it was my upper body, I'd call Phil Niekro. I mean, I would call Tim Wakefield. If it was my lower body, wow, I'd call Phil Niekro. And that's how I kind of weaved together, you know, when I was wrong, Dan Worthen was awesome. We had a great relationship, but he would always encourage me, "Hey man, I don't know if I know the answers to these questions. Why don't you call Phil? Why don't you call Tim?" And it was helpful.
Oh, that's great. You know, anyway, it was unbelievable. And I talk about it all the time. I have a lot of people ask me, you know, about, you know, during that season, you know, when did he ever, you know, when he struggled, what'd you think? I said, he didn't struggle. But two or three times. I mean, and because it was such a unique pitch, not very many people had answers for you. So I wanted to find out who did. So, John, I know you probably have some questions for RA, and please feel free.
Definitely. I mean, there's very few. I think there's Matt Walden is a knuckleballer at MLB right now. Obviously, the game of pitching has changed so much since even you last pitched. Everyone's chasing velo, spin rate. They're teaching this at a very young age. There's a lot of controversy when it comes to pitching in the major leagues right now. What's your opinion of what's going on in the game right now with major league pitching, and even earlier when these kids are getting trained at a young age?
Well, you know, I happen to agree with you. You know, I think we're in a generation now that it's just evolved. And because so many teams put an emphasis on the metrics that you've talked about, guys are starting to train earlier and earlier. So they're setting themselves up for tissue breakdown early in their career. It's not a matter really now of, is this guy going to have Tommy John or blow out his labrum? It's a matter of, when he does, what are we going to do? It's inevitable now. I mean, it really is. And so organizations are starting to just stack their holsters with all these guys that throw 97. So next man up, when the guy that throws 100 blows out, well, we got another one down here that throws 97. We'll try to get him in the same position. And it's kind of feeding itself. I think because of the way baseball is now, there's even more value in a knuckleball guy. I mean, could you imagine sandwiching me in between, you know, Jordan Hicks from St. Louis in the back end of that bullpen, or any organization now? Or, you know, it would just be really, really difficult for a team the third time through the lineup to see a knuckleball and then have to shift back to a guy throwing 98, you know, with a wipeout slider. There is a real need in Major League Baseball for a different look, you know, and I think that a knuckleball would fit perfectly on a number of organizations. And so my hope is that, you know, you have organizations that are still around that believe in the merit of the pitch and, you know, have the patience. One of the things I really always appreciated about Terry and a lot of the guys that managed me, where they were, you know, they knew that there, when it looked bad, it could really look bad, right? Like, that's a knuckleball. It can really look bad. But if it's good, it can give you a real asset. Terry knew that. And there were a lot of times he would just have, I'm sure he had to sit on his hands, you know, do I go get him? No, I don't. Do I go get him? No, I don't. Because I could find the pitch in like the fourth inning and then all of a sudden run off six innings of scoreless baseball just because I found the release point. And he knew that. Like, and he would give me the benefit of the doubt on that. And there were certain nights where, you know, I might have broken my nail. I'll never forget in Washington, you know, it was the opening day for our team and I broke a nail in the second inning and he had to get me out of there earlier. And it's hard as a competitor to go up to him and say, "Hey man, like, I want to be in the game and I want to be pitching, but it's not the best thing for the team because they're going to start hitting me and I'm not going to have a lot of control with it. You might need to get somebody else in the game." And that's hard to do, but to his credit, you know, we had that kind of relationship. And that's why I won so many games. It wasn't just because I was great, is that he knew how to manage me and we had a great connection as far as communication goes. And Josh Tully was great too. So, you know, he would give me great feedback, and he was unbelievable. I mean, the majority of my, you know, 120 wins came with him. And so he played a special part. But to answer your question in short, I think now is a great time to see kind of a resurrection of the pitch. In fact, I'm working with two guys with the Toronto Blue Jays organization right now that both throw pretty good ones. And so there are organizations out there that do believe that it has something to add.
Well, you know, talking about Toronto, I know you spent time up there, obviously. You had a whole country rather than here in the States. I'd like to get your comparisons on the Met fans, on the philosophy, their mindset in comparison to maybe the fans up in Toronto or some of the other places that you've pitched.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to compare anything to my experience in New York, just because, you know, the connection I felt with that fan base, I felt like there was a real relationship that they kind of went through with me over those 3 years that I was there. And thankfully, you know, Johan Santana told me something that was really funny when I got there. He said, "Listen, man," he said, "there's no better place in the world to play baseball when you're good in New York. And there's no worse place to play if you're not good." And so he's right. He is right. And thankfully, by God's grace, you know, I had a good run while I was there and got opportunities to really connect with the fans. So it's kind of an unfair question. I'm going to be completely biased. But, you know, the thing that I really enjoyed about Toronto was how much they wanted a winner. You know, it had been a number of years since they had been back to the playoffs, Joe Carter, you know, the Mitch Williams, that whole thing. And we were, you know, we were working towards that. And they're a hockey bunch. And so they are fired up. They want a winner, and they'll show up if you're winning. And I would say from just a, you know, baseball IQ standpoint, you know, the Mets fan base, like they could follow a game and they knew, like, you know, you're getting, like, you get clapped for if you, you know, give up five runs in seven innings in Toronto, right? That's a horrible outing for me. Like, I think that's a horrible outing. In New York, they're almost booing you. Like, they get it. Like, they, you know, they grew up with it. So, you know, it's just probably that. But, man, nothing was more electric for me as a player than 2015 and 16 when we were in the playoffs and a couple of games from going to the World Series, and that place, the dome was shut, and it was standing room only, and we were playing the Rangers or the Indians or whoever it was, and that place was bananas. I mean, my heart was coming out of my throat, and I wasn't even pitching. And so, you know, it was pretty electric and neat. And they really do get behind their sports teams, especially if you're winning. You know, they're incredible.
Yeah, the bat flip heard around the world also. That was a huge part of that. I wanted to ask you one other question and turn it back to Terry. I mean, during the offseason of 2011 and 2012, you announced that you would risk your 2012 salary to climb Mount Kilimanjaro to support the Bombay Team Challenge. And you, along with Mets bullpen catcher Dave Racanello, former MLB pitcher Kevin Slowly, you raised over $100,000 for the organization. What was that experience like?
Well, you know, I would say it was pretty life-changing, to be honest. You know, I think the consequence of losing my contract, or, you know, I think that was kind of media fodder at the time. It wasn't really, you know, I never felt like I was going to be at risk. You know, there were a couple of technical parts to the climb, but nothing that I felt like I was going to get injured and not be able to perform. So, you know, that was something that was kind of spun, you know, kind of, you know, Mets versus RA and all that. I think Jeff Wilpon even gave to our cause. So it's not like there was any animosity around that. They had to formally send me a letter from the HR department through their legal team, that warning me that if something did happen, they did have the right to void my contract. And that was just a formality. I mean, I never really paid much attention to that. But as far as the experience went, you know, I mean, we were trying to raise money for the Bombay Teen Challenge, which was, you know, they rescue human beings from trafficking in India. And I had a connection to that organization. And so when we did that, that was the mission. The mission was, how can I use my platform of baseball to try to be part of the greater story going on around me? I mean, that's what I felt like is the right way to live. And so, you know, that's what I would try to do. And I thankfully had a lot of people support us, and tons of Mets fans got involved. I got to write a journal for the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, it was really a neat experience.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah. All right. You know, I know you're an avid reader. I know you like to read a lot of books, and I've read your book twice. Have you done any more writing? Have you thought about doing anything else? Because I know, you know, that's a big part of your life, is that, you know, the reading and the writing side.
Thanks for that question, Terry. Yeah. You know, I kind of dabble around with it now. You know, it was pretty exhausting, you know, when I went through that. You know, I wrote the book, and it came out in the 2012 year, and it was just a really hard process, as you might imagine, because of the content, but also because of, you know, the time commitment. Because I wrote it during the 2011 season mostly, and it came out in 2012, and so, you know, it was hard to manage all that. And I'm not going to say I got burnt out from trying to get published again or something like that. I write now, but it's just more for catharsis, just for myself. You know, and I do enjoy it. I still love reading, and I'm find time to do that. And, yeah, that's still a big part of my life. Both my girls are, you know, I think it's rubbed off on them. They're really good writers, and they do some of that in college. And so it's been fun to kind of read their stuff and give them pointers and things like that.
You know, Ari, one of the things that I've done, and I didn't, you know, everybody lives a different life, but, you know, I do a lot of speaking around and talk about things that have, you know, helped me become who I was, and, you know, kind of driven with the competition side. But, you know, after reading your book, have you done any speaking to help? I mean, there's a lot of things in your book that would inspire people who have, you know, had struggled at times, you know, as a young adult. And how you beat that coming through that, you know, after reading your book. I mean, there's something to go out and share that with other people. Have you thought about speaking on those subjects?
Yeah, I have, Terry, actually. And I think that's probably why I don't write as much, is because that's one of the overflows of the book, was I have had an opportunity. And thankfully, you know, I had a lot of people who I worked with, both sports psychologists and counselors and all kinds of stuff, to kind of make my way through that stuff mentally. And so thankfully I was at a place where I would get to share that, you know, like I felt like I was healthy enough to talk about it and about my past and about my journey. And so to answer your question in short, that's one of my passions, actually, is getting to go around and talk about my story and try to help people, you know, just through my own personal journey, maybe come to grips with some of the things that are more difficult about their own journeys, and to help them know they're not alone. I think that was the biggest thing for me when I started doing my real life work, was I felt so alone for so long. And when I really got to the understanding that there were people out there that loved me and cared about me and wanted to help me through whatever it was, no matter how dramatic or traumatic it might have been, that's when everything for me, both relationally with my marriage and my relationships with my friends and my kids and my vocation as a baseball player, started to really ascend. It's because I was freed up from all that wreckage, you know, that had been haunting me for so long. And I get to talk about that. And it's one of life's privileges for me to get to do that.
Well, it was a great read. I like I said, I've read it twice. I think it's one of the great stories going. And obviously, you're the epitome of someone who, you know, was brave enough to look in the mirror and face his demons and get to the ultimate and became one of the greatest pitchers in the game. And I just want to thank you so much for taking some time today to be on our podcast. And, you know, one of my favorite people, and obviously, you know, a lot of times, every fifth day, I had a big smile on my face going to Citi Field or wherever we were to watch you pitch. So thanks, R.A., for being on the show. John, I know you've got some questions from some of the fans for R.A.
Yes, we do. I'm going to segue from that last topic right into this question from Amanda Kohut. That was on X. Ask R.A. what he is reading these days. I miss his interviews because he always had great book picks.
Yeah, okay. So I'm reading a really interesting story. It's historical nonfiction right now. It's called Undaunted Courage, and it's about the Lewis and Clark Expedition West. And it's really, really fascinating. And so that's what I'm in the middle of right now. I think before that, I read a book along with my kids that I really enjoyed called Sound of Thunder, Hear My Cry. And so I like to read the books that my kids are reading so we can talk about it at the dinner table some. And although they're middle school books, you know, like my 13-year-old right now is reading The Outsiders. Great book. Love that book. Great movie. So I'm reading a number of different books, but Undaunted Courage is the one that I read for myself. Like I'm about halfway through that and really enjoyed it.
Excellent. Another question. This one comes from one of our fans on Instagram. What point in 2012 did you realize, dang, I got a shot at winning the NL Cy Young?
I think maybe, you know, it's funny because, and Terry probably has been around guys that have had a similar answer to this question, but I really didn't think about it until the last month of the season, really. I mean, I was so focused, and Terry can tell you, like, the only thing that mattered to me was my work. That's it. Like, how do I get to the mound 2 days after my start? How do I play long catch the right day? How do I prepare for the next opponent? How do I get the scouting report from Dan Worthen the right way on the right day? Like, all I cared about was my work. That's it. And then the last month of the season, you know, you would look up or you'd watch SportsCenter just to see the highlights. And across the bottom, it would give you, like, you know, front runners for the Cy Young or Kershaw and Cueto and Dickey and, you know. And then you started thinking about it a little bit, maybe. And I will tell you and admit to you, probably, you know, during the, I think I had about 4 starts left of the season. And I could feel myself kind of getting tired, like mentally, like holding it all. And, you know, much as the way in baseball, you know, you lean on your teammates. And David Wright probably wouldn't remember this, but he was a real encouragement to me. He said, hey, man, just finish strong. Finish strong. Like, we're here for you. Like, our season hasn't happened the way we want, but, you know, people are coming to the park to see you pitch and we're behind you. And, you know, it was a real encouragement to me when he did that. And he might not even remember it, but it meant a lot to me. And I thought about it probably the last month of the season about that. And getting the 20th win was big. Getting the 20th win at home was huge. I mean, that might have been my third favorite start, even though I think I gave up 3 runs and 8 innings or something. That was one of my favorite starts, just because, you know, we weren't playing for anything except for kind of what that might look like to have that in the Mets organization, you know. And what, like, the thing that I really never thought about until probably the last 2 days of the season was, like, no other knuckleballer had ever done it. And so what a great thing to get to celebrate with Phil and Charlie and Tim. You know, those guys were incredibly generous with who they were, you know, to me.
Great season, great accomplishment. Met fans remember it well. We'll never forget it, actually. It was a fabulous, fabulous year for you. Last question from the fans, and this is really directed to you and Terry. I'd be interested in hearing what RA's reaction was when the trade to the Blue Jays went down, and what was Terry's feeling on it as well?
Well, I'll go first, Terry, and then you can.
Okay.
You know, I was at a point in my career where I was not naive. And Sandy Alderson and I always had a really good relationship, you know. So if I had a real question, I'd go straight to him. And he was very honest with me about how, you know, they were shopping me around, and it had nothing to do with anything other than a business transaction, which I understood. Like, that's baseball. That's part of it. And so my feelings were not hurt because they wanted to try to make their team better for everybody that had supported them since they've been an infant. So I get that part. I won't say that I wasn't sad. You know, I was really sad about it because that is where I had resurrected my career and had great relationship with the manager and, you know, was comfortable and knew my way around. And, you know, for a guy from Tennessee to know his way around New York, like, that's, you know, that's special. And so I was really sad. And my family was sad. My family loved New York. We loved it. We had a great time there and, you know, great relationship. So I was sad, and it had everything to do with relationship and nothing to do with me being upset that they wanted to trade me. I got that part. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, hopefully I was going to go to a place that we would contend.
Well, I will tell you, all right, I'll start out by saying I was sad. There's no question about it. You know, I knew the importance of pitching, and here I have a guy I just won the Cy Young Award that, you know, I'm losing to another club. But I also was well aware that we were trying to build the organization, and as it turned out, we got two huge pieces back that, you know, was part of the business side. But no, when it first happened, I was crushed and just thought, my gosh, how hard is it to replace a guy like that? And but, you know, it was not my decisions, and but I felt bad. But I was, you know, again, one of those things where, you know, when you left, you know, I couldn't root for you any harder than I did not being next to you. So, but I will tell you, you know, as you said, it's part of the business. And yeah, there's a lot of people who were traded in my career, my time in New York, that I was sad they got traded also. So, but we missed you. And again, but I had a chance to watch one of the greatest years a pitcher's ever had. And that was a fun and a great year for me. So again, thanks so much for being on the show. I know John and I have enjoyed it. The fans are going to love it. And let's try to stay in touch.
My pleasure, Terry. Love you, man. Thanks for everything.
What an incredible guy R.A. Dickey is. Thank you so much for bringing him on today, Terry.
Well, he is one of the best. I mean, you just heard a guy who's so well-spoken, was so focused, you know, knew exactly what he had to do, prepared himself off the charts. I mean, you're talking about days at the end of spring training when guys were leaving the field and he was still in the cage bunting or just trying to work on his hit or taking extra ground balls and working on throwing the ball to second base for double plays. You know, he was going to be a master at his trade, and certainly he was for a long time. But I'll tell you, that season he won the Cy Young, there was no better.
No, there wasn't. There wasn't. What a great interview. Once again, thank you for bringing him on. And now we have some questions for Ask the Skipper. So why don't we get to those right now? This one comes in from Freeport, Long Island, from Bob. Bob writes, on the last episode, Terry mentioned he was in the organization's minor league field coordinator for the 2010 season prior to becoming a manager. What did that position entail? And what were some of those memorable experiences that you could recall during that time? And was it important for you to have that role before becoming manager in 2011?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, it was, you know, I had been the minor league director and the field coordinator for the Dodgers many years ago. But the field coordinator's job is one of the best jobs in baseball. You know, you have a boss, they have a guy who oversees all the minor leagues, and he deals with contracts and insurances. But the field coordinator's job is to set down policy of how we're going to play the game on the field. So basically what you do is you coach the coaches. You know, you've got a great staff of players or a great staff of coaches. And what you want to do is say, hey, look, here's how we're going to teach this. That's how we're going to, you know, and get everybody together and then make sure that's cohesive throughout the organization as the season goes along. So what's being taught in AAA is being taught in AA and vice versa. And the conversation between the staffs, you know, has to be coherent, has to be, hey, when you move a guy up, you're going to call him here. This is what he needs to work on. And then make sure that's getting done. That was one of the things I used to do. I would go through a system and I would tell the managers, I'd go see a seat team, let's say in here in Port St. Lucie. And after I'd watch them for 5 days, I'd go in and talk to the manager and we'd talk about maybe certain players, things they have to work on. And I said, now my next time here, they better be better. They're not, I mean, I want to see improvement. And that's basically what the job of. And obviously being able to learn everybody in the organization, like I did, and the next year becoming the manager of the team was absolutely a tremendous benefit. It was spring training, all the young, I knew them. I knew all those young players. They knew me. So you already established a relationship. I had been with the big league spring training the year before as the field coordinator. So I knew a lot of the guys that that were on that team. So it was all easier transition to go from coming in as the field coordinator in an organization than coming in from the outside.
Excellent. Thanks, Terry. You have one more today, and this is from Steve from Astoria in Queens, New York. On Monday, April 15th, MLB honored the life and legacy of Jackie Robinson with the annual Jackie Robinson Day. As a minor league instructor, coordinator with the Dodgers as well, you were around a lot of guys that were or knew and maybe have played with Jackie back in the day with the Brooklyn Dodgers. What did you learn about from these guys about who Jackie Robinson was? And how important is it to carry on the legacy of Jackie to future generations of players and fans?
Yeah, well, I will tell you, John, we'll start out. The Dodger organization is a tremendously historic, famous organization. I mean, they still do things today that include guys that played 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And when I first went to the Dodgers, I mean, Jackie wasn't there, but Roy Campanella was there, Koufax, Drysdale, Maury Wills, some of the greats were always around in spring training, and they continually told stories about, you know, their days when they were playing, and Jackie was involved in a lot of them. There was the scouting director's name was Ben Wade, and Ben was an outstanding pitcher for the Dodgers many years ago, and becomes the scouting director, and he knew Jackie so well. He used to talk about how he handled getting ready for a game. He knew he was going to be booed. He knew he was going to be threatened. And yet he had such tremendous confidence in who he was as a player and almost, you know, took it as, you know, I'm going to show you you're wrong about who I am, and just took it and played with a little bit of a chip on his shoulder, which you had to back then. And so those stories and how he approached the game. I remember Mr. Campanis, who was the general manager of the Dodgers, told me about how he and Jackie went out and worked endlessly about turning double plays, and how Jackie, you know, he'd share ideas on, you know, where he wanted to throw or where he had to throw the ball. And so not only was he just a talented guy, but he worked at his trade to become great.
Well, number 42.
And by the way, that legacy has to live on. The players have to know. They have to know what he stood for to make that's made the game great.
Well, that's why the number 42 will never be worn by another player other than that April 15th game where everyone wears number 42 in honor of Jackie Robinson. Well, if you want to ask Terry a question each and every week, we do have the Ask the Skipper segment. You can submit your questions on social media or send an email to the Terry Collins Show at gmail.com. Simply follow Terry on X, Instagram, at @TerryCollins_10. And for those of you on Facebook, we have a Facebook page now for the Terry Collins Show. Check it out. Terry, that's going to about wrap it up for this week. But as we do, we like to tease a little bit what's happening in the next episode. And I think you got another good one lined up for us.
I got a great one lined up. But, you know, I met a guy when I first came on as the field coordinator, and I watched him in spring training my first year. He got hurt, and I spent the entire summer sitting with Dan Murphy in the stands and watching minor league baseball games. He was there every night watching, talking baseball. When I finally got the job, he was somebody I wanted to have on my team and in the game. And obviously in 2015, put on one of the greatest shows the Mets fans have ever seen. So we're going to have Dan Murphy on next week.
I can't wait for that, and the fans will look forward to that as well, Terry. That about wraps up this episode of the Terry Collins Show. Make sure to subscribe now to Terry Collins on all the social media platforms, YouTube, Instagram. We're everywhere, so we appreciate that support. Until next time, this is John Arezzi for Terry Collins. Let's go Mets.